Thanks very much, Dominique. One of the things you failed to mention is I've written a few books in my time. One of the books I wrote was on the problem of suffering. The title of the book was Why Do People Suffer? And when the proofs came back from the printers, they'd left off the question mark. So the title of the book ran, Why Do People Suffer? James Jones. So this is probably what you might be thinking about half an hour's time. It's certainly what the Diocese of Liverpool, I think, have felt for the last 15 years when I was Bishop of Liverpool. I want to make a confession at the start. Obviously, I am not an economist, and therefore I'm not trying to give you any perspective as an economist. I am basically a pastor, and therefore the perspective that I bring to you today is the perspective of a pastor. Although I have to say, all my brothers are in business, very successfully in business, and they say to me, well, actually, James, you're in the same business as we are, because you're there just selling a product like we are, because, you know, there you are peddling religion, and you're just trying to persuade people to buy in to what you're offering, to which I say, well, at least I believe in my product. Which is a bit unfair, I think, to business people, because I have met one or two people, business people, who do indeed believe in their product. As Dominique has said, I was invited, having done quite a bit of broadcasting over the years, by Radio 4 to do a series called The Bishop and the Bankers. This is because the previous year I had done a series, again for Radio 4, called The Bishop and the Prisoner. I should stress that there is no connection between the bishop and the banker and the bishop and the prisoner, although some people do think that the latter are more associated with the former. And what is interesting about the banking crisis is that some people have said that the banks are too big to fail, and others have added, and the bankers too powerful to jail. And it is significant that there have been no bankers sent to jail for any of the alleged misdemeanors. I think the worst that has happened is that some have been stripped of their honors. But what I want to start by doing is telling you a story or a parable. So let me begin. Imagine that one day a very rich friend says to you that they want to give you the treat of a lifetime. They want to take you on a cruise. And all they say to you is, sign yourself off from whatever you're doing and just get down to the pierhead in Liverpool and I'll take you on the best holiday you've ever had. It's all on me. Don't have to think of bringing any money. But there are only two conditions. The first is that on this trip, you're never to ask where we're going, and you're never to ask when we're going to get there. So you think to yourself, well, sounds pretty good. Get yourself to Liverpool. And there at the pierhead, standing in the River Mersey, is the most extraordinary ship that you've ever set eyes on in your life. Better than those owned by Russian oligarchs. It's extraordinary. And you're taken to your suite on A deck, and it takes your breath away. Such luxury. Go to the bars and the restaurants, the food is out of this world, and within a couple of days, you are sailing in the sun. And if there's a heaven, you think it could not be any better than what you are experiencing. Well, anyway, after 6 weeks of sailing around on this wonderful ship, the question pops into your mind, well, I wonder where we're going, and I wonder when we're going to get there. But for the sake of this story, you're British, so stiff upper lip, and you've made a promise that you'll never ask these two questions, and you swallow the question, and you carry on enjoying yourself. After 6 months of sailing around on this ship, you can hold the question in no longer, and you meet your host on A deck, and you say, dear, excuse me, please don't think I'm being ungrateful, but I just wondered, you know, where we were going. Is there a problem, he says? Is there something not to your liking? Is your cabin uncomfortable? Do you not like the... No, no, you say, it's wonderful, it's fantastic, it's great. So he says to you, then, my friend, eat, drink, be merry, have the time of your life. So you do your best. After 10 years of sailing around on this wretched cruise ship, this dream cruise has become a nightmare. And you grab your host by the lapels and you scream into his face, tell me, please, please, where are we going and when are we going to get there? Ridiculous? Not really. Here we are on this planet Earth, like a spaceship cruising through space. And every now and again, every single one of the travelers asks at some stage along the way, where's it going? When do we get there? Well, imagine you recover your composure and you say to your host, tell me, how many people are on this ship? And he says to you, go on, guess. No, I got you. Go on, guess. So you say, okay, 200. Now he said, I knew you'd say that. But actually, he said, on this ship, there are 1,000 people. What? 1,000 people? That's amazing, because it only feels like 200. What an amazing ship. Ah, he said, yes. Because you see, here on A deck, there are only 200 people. But for the last 10 years, below decks, in the hold of this ship, there are 800 people sailing with us. And they've been on bread and water. Ridiculous? Well, not really. Because here on this planet Earth, like a spaceship cruising through space, 200 of us are on the deck, and 800 are in the hold of the ship. 20% of us are on A deck, and 80% are in the hold of the ship. I want to offer a pastoral perspective tonight under the title Just Economics. What responsibility do those people with power who run the world economy have for the 80% in the hold of the ship? Those who are environmental refugees, those who are affected by climate change. But the issue about climate change is that those people who feel it's happening have no power to do anything about it, and those who do have the power to do something about it don't feel it. What about the 80% who are in the hold of the ship? Those who do economics, do those who do economics have any sense of responsibility for the 80%? And the reason I was glad to receive Dominic's invitation to speak on this particular course is that here in this university so famous for its business and economics, it seemed to me that you were beginning to grapple with not just the science of the economy, but the ethics of the economy. And it seems to me that people are aware of the necessity for justice in this world. Interestingly, one of the first phrases that a child comes out with when you're sharing the sweets is, that's not fair. Where does that come from? Is that nature or nurture? Is that conscience or conditioning? Maybe you'd like to pursue that during the time of questions. But the fact is that people do have an innate sense of justice. I was brought up in a time when we were told that morality was relative. It just depended on what society you were conditioned by. I don't think that's true. And I don't think it's true anymore. And in our own time, I believe there is what I call a new media morality. A morality that's reinforced by the media that shapes our whole existence. I'll give you one example. Racism. Nobody today says that racism is relatively bad. People say that racism is absolutely bad. When this world rose up against apartheid in South Africa, they didn't say, oh, it depended how you were brought up, whether you were brought up to think that whites were superior, blacks were inferior. No, people said, however you've been brought up, for one race to dominate another is wrong. Not relatively wrong, not relative to your conditioning, but absolutely wrong. I believe that showed that the world sensed, intuited, that there were some absolute values. I remember when Nelson Mandela came to this country for the very first state visit after he'd been released from prison. And on the last night of his state visit, he was in the Royal Albert Hall, sitting in the royal box next to the Queen for a wonderful concert of African music. And right at the end, all the singers and dancers came onto the stage for a final reprise, and the whole audience rose in their seats and began boogieing away with the dancers on stage. And there was Nelson Mandela, even though he was sat next to the Queen, he stood in the royal box, and he too started boogieing. And I heard this reported on the radio. When he did that, apparently the Queen, it was reported, then stood and swayed gently and clapped her hands. But it was a messianic picture. It was the sight of somebody infused with a sense of justice coming to the very heart of the establishment that had been party to his oppression and standing for liberty, for freedom, and for justice. So I think this new media morality that we have today is about justice and about fairness. And one of the things which stuck in the throat of people over the banking crisis is that it seemed to be so unfair. Because in this banking crisis, the profits of the past were privatized so the bankers could all enjoy them. But when it came to the losses, they were socialized so that everybody had to pay. You probably know these figures better than I do. But the banking crisis in this country cost every adult, on average, £7,500. But the inequity of it all is that the austerity that has followed has hit the poor. So the bankers enjoyed the profits when those monies came in. But when the losses came, it was the poor that bore the brunt. So, Liverpool, where I was bishop for 15 years, there have been swingeing cuts at a time when banks have been bailed out by billions. It's the social fund, the social care, that has taken the hit. And that leaves people feeling just like a young child seeing the sweets shared out unfairly. That's not fair. So those who have the power to shape the economy, where is justice in today's economics? Another of the aspects of the new morality, I believe, is a growing passion for the environment, especially amongst young people. A few years ago, I went around the whole of my diocese, which encompasses some of the most challenging areas in the country. I went into 16 different schools, and I asked to meet with as many 16 to 18-year-olds as possible, because I wanted to hear their dreams and dreads about the future. I wanted to tell them why I thought that the Christian ethic was still relevant 2,000 years on. And to get the discussion going, we produced a short video clip about the future of the planet. What would happen if we didn't intervene now and stop some of the desecration of the Earth that was taking place? And at the end of this admittedly pretty apocalyptic presentation, I asked all these young people in the 16 different schools this question: how worried are you about the future of the earth? Naught is, I'm not worried at all. 10 is, I'm really worried. I said, would you now put your hands up if you placed yourself between 5 and 10? This is no exaggeration. In every single school, 100% of all the hands went up. I was actually taken aback by that. So I followed it up with this question. Okay, given your anxiety about the future of the planet, to what extent do you think we ought to do something about it? I said, please notice that little word ought, because it's a moral word, and we might start digging around asking where it comes from. Naught is, don't bother. 10 is, you really ought to do something now, immediately. I said, please put your hands up if you place yourself between 5 and 10 on the scale. 99% of the hands went up in those 16 different schools. And these were areas of quite considerable deprivation. These were areas where young people were really living on the edge, and it impressed me that they were concerned about the future of the planet. My own sense is that there is a generational divide when it comes to sustainability and caring for the environment, considering the future of the earth. Maybe it's because young people see the earth as their inheritance and wonder about it being squandered, this inheritance, about the previous generation. There's a great African proverb which says, we have borrowed the present from our children. It's interesting how that my generation, the generation above, are quite happy to call this world and our society the consumer society. Have you ever thought about that word? What does consume mean? It means to eat, devour, and destroy. Do you not think that the social historians of the 22nd century might not look back in incredulity at how we in the 21st century could so call ourselves the consumer society without appreciating the irony of that title? Because we are indeed the consumer society. We are consuming the earth's resources as if it were some limitless larder, which it's not, without any real sense of our responsibility to future generations. And they would look back, it seems to me, and say, but did they not have the science to tell them what it was that they were doing on this ship where only 20% of them are on ADEC and 80% are in the hold of the ship? When I did this series on Radio 4, The Bishop and the Bankers, I tried to get beneath the surface of what the bankers were doing, to probe and to prod, to see whether they had any ethical understanding of banking and the banking crisis. You'll probably know that when it comes to ethics, you should have regard for 3 different aspects: the intent, the action, and the consequence. Why is it that you are intending to do X, Y, or Z? That's the intent. The action, how are you doing it? How will you do your economics? How will you do business? The nature of the action, the activity. And thirdly, the consequence. What is the outcome? What will happen if you pursue those activities? What will be the result? And if you want to work out what an ethical basis is for your economics, it seems to me that you too need to have regard to the intent, the action, and the consequence of those actions. In the 18th century, the freemen of the city of London were given a little book when they became freemen called Conduct for Life. And this is rule one that was read to them as they were admitted to the freedom of the city. These were the guilds, the trades, the unions of the day. This is a modern English version of rule one from Conduct of Life. When you plan to do anything, think about the purpose and possible outcomes, and be sure that they are good. It is foolish to act without knowing why you act and considering the possible results. Further, it is total stupidity to plan for a bad or evil outcome. If you follow this, you will have a clear conscience. Well, when I heard those words read to me at the heart of the City of London in the Church of St. Lawrence Jewry, it made me wonder what difference there would be in the City of London if today all the men and women in business practiced that particular principle. I wonder how you would feel if it were given you on the first day of your course here in this university. What is the intent? What is the nature of the action? Now, when it comes to activities, especially in banking, you can have the full scope from the good, the very good, through to the very bad. I interviewed a huge number of people for the programs, and I'm about to read to you what I was told by a former mortgage bond salesman. This is how he described his work to me. Every day, he said, you put on your psychological armor and your helmet, and you try and put points on the board, make sales, and in the case of traders, profit, buy low and sell high. And, he went on, you need to steel yourself for financial warfare, and you need to be aggressive, and you need to be tough, and it's not a place for emotions, it's not a place for spiritual development, and so you end up emphasizing parts of your personality and letting other parts be stunted. He went on, the enemy is the other firms competing for the same business, and you're serving clients, but you don't want them to get the better of you, and you know whose flag you fly and ultimately who you work for, which is the firm. I then suggested to him that one of the problems of banking, and I use this phrase, that it squeezed the humanity out of the transaction. That when you were dealing, did you have any thought for the person who would be losing their mortgage? Did you have any thought for the person whose pension fund was being raided? And when I put that question to him about squeezing the humanity out of the banking transaction, there was a lot of sighing. You'll hear it if you go onto BBC iPlayer. And then he says these words, I just don't think that's the right question. Restoring humanity to the transaction, he said, is putting the emphasis in the wrong place. Well, is it? You're the economists. You tell me. In the same program, I interviewed Anthony Jenkins, who is the recently appointed chief executive of Barclays Banks, and he was quite clear that the culture of banking needed changing, and that the way to changing the culture of banking was nothing less than leadership. And that it was up to the leadership of the bank to inculcate a new set of values, which he identified as being respect, integrity, service, excellence, and interestingly, stewardship. These are the values he believed need to be transfused into an organization to make it ethical banking. So that's the intent, that's the activity. You can have the salesman or the chief executive, and you can choose which of those are the ethical actions, and then the consequences. Now, it seems to me, as a pastor, that banks have a crucial role in wealth creation. And indeed, I went to interview Simon Collins, the head of KPMG, and these are his words. He says that there is a grander purpose to business, quote, essentially to enrich and be a part of wider society. It's not just about enriching at the expense of, but enriching communities in which we operate. That seems to me to be an ethical outcome. Unfortunately, what happened with the banks is that they were dominated by people that seemed to simply be making money out of money rather than using money to create wealth. And I have to say, I was staggered when I discovered that when it came to banks, only 3% of the bank's assets were equity, in other words, their own money, and 97% of the money that they were playing with was borrowed money. And it seems to me, from a layperson's point of view, that balance has to change if banking is to perform a proper social good. Now, when it comes to the outcome of any action, banking, business, or any activity, it's foolish not to recognize that all human activity has an environmental impact. There is no human action that is environmentally neutral. What we have to ensure is that our actions are sustainable. I have to confess that I too have flown EasyJet and budget airlines. In fact, I remember taking a flight from Belfast to Liverpool. Our airport is now grandly known as the John Lennon International Airport in Liverpool. And as I was getting on the plane at Belfast, I wasn't wearing a dog collar, I was just a sort of casual open-neck shirt, got onto this plane. As I came up the steps, I could see the storm clouds gathering. I thought, this doesn't look good at all for this flight. And sure enough, we took off and flew into the biggest thunderstorm that I've ever flown through in my life. I've done quite a bit of flying, and I've never been in anything like this. And we were buffeted around the skies. Everybody was strapped in. Flight attendants were strapped in. Nobody was talking. Everybody was pretending to read. You knew this because their books, magazines were upside down. But everybody was just giving the impression. They just hoped that this plane was going to land safely. And indeed, as we landed, I'm here to tell the tale, so obviously we landed safely. But as we landed at John Lennon Airport and taxied along the runway, the guy sitting next to me said, he said, actually, I knew this was going to be a really bad flight. He said, I knew it was going to be a terrible flight. He said, but I didn't want to tell you. He said, because I didn't want to frighten you. He said, actually, I'm an airline pilot. And then he turned to me and he said, what do you do? I said, actually, I'm a priest, but I didn't tell you because I didn't want to frighten you. But the fact is that we all travel, we all have an impact upon our environment, but the ethical activity is one which examines that as to whether or not that activity can be sustainable. And what I was amazed by when I did the radio series is that there was no ethical training given to any of the people that I interviewed for these programs. Nobody was ever asked to consider the ethical impact. Nobody was asked to consider what the sustainable impact was of any of their actions. Now, please don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-business. I'm not anti-capital. But I do think that we need to work towards an ethical capitalism. I've often addressed chambers of commerce, and when people have said to me, what are you as a bishop doing addressing chambers of commerce, my answer is quite simple, because successful business is vitally important for the welfare of families and communities. We need to have successful businesses. We need to have successful and ethical entrepreneurs. Because when real jobs are created, real salaries are paid, then the economic benefits of these do secure the welfare of communities. And I believe that the future stability of our society and the future stability of the world depends upon ethical and just economics. But let me end by giving you a third part to the parable of the cruise ship. So there they all are on this luxury liner, the 200 on A deck and the 800 in the hold of the ship. And suddenly, from nowhere, comes the most violent storm. So much so that it looks as if the ship is going to break up. So they rush for the lifeboats, but as you've already guessed, there are lifeboats only for the 200 on A deck, and they're duly filled and lowered into the water and set sail. And they look back to see the ship, which they now believe, with the 800 on board, is destined for destruction, except a miracle happens, and the storm passes as quickly as it has come. And the people in the lifeboats look up, and there, on A deck, waving through the windows of their luxury cabins, are the 800. Ridiculous?